Its current state on 90.5 WKAR. In the late 1980s, New York City was a city divided. While wealth was rolling in from the booming financial industry, neighborhoods were falling apart. Drug wars and crime plagued the city. Ken Burns' film, The Central Park Five, reminds us of the atmosphere of the time.
All of a sudden, teenagers have lots of cash and guns. And all hell breaks loose in Bedford-Stuyvesant. All hell breaks loose in Harlem. All hell breaks loose in Brownsville, East New York. We were supposed to be afraid. It would have been irrational not to be afraid.
Amid these tensions, on the night of April 19, 1989, a young white woman was raped in Central Park and left for dead. The city was outraged by the crime, and the next day, police arrested five black and Latino teenagers, and the media frenzy began.
In New York City this morning, a jogger is fighting for her life after a brutal attack in Central Park.
Viciously battered and unconscious, wearing only a jogging bra, her hands tied over her mouth.
The suspects are 14 and 15-year-olds who blazed a nighttime trail of terror.
Assaulting an elderly man, attacking a male runner, hitting another person with a lead pipe. At one time, the group was running in a pack of more than 25 youths.
With scant incriminating evidence, coerced inaccurate confessions, and no eyewitnesses, Antron McRae, Kevin Richardson, Raymond Santana, Corey Wise, and Yousef Salaam were convicted of rape. More than a decade later, Mattis Reyes, a convicted serial rapist, confessed to attacking the Central Park jogger. A positive DNA match backed up his claim, and the five were exonerated. In 2003, the men filed a lawsuit against the city of New York for malicious prosecution, racial discrimination, and emotional distress. 10 years later, the case is still not settled, but recent developments suggest it may be resolved soon. Last week, Ken Burns told HuffPo Live that when New York Mayor-elect Bill de Blasio takes office, he will settle the case. Two of the Central Park Five, Yousef Salaam and Raymond Santana, were in East Lansing for a film screening last week. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with the pair shortly after Ken Burns' announcement of de Blasio's intention to settle the case once and for all. This interview does address sensitive topics and may not be suitable for all listeners. After two decades, Yousef Salaam still remembers the night that changed his life forever.
April 19, 1989 was a notable day for me. I think I came home from school, and as I would always do, I probably changed my clothes and went outside to play. We lived in Schaumburg Plaza at the time, and it was something that, as children, we always did. You know, especially doing something like hanging out in Central Park. That was one of the most normal things that a child living across the street from Central Park would do. And the interesting thing about me is that I have a background in art and design and things like that. So I would always be interested in nature and Central Park, just taking long walks and just being absorbed by that whole thing. So it wasn't unfamiliar territory to me. This particular situation was something that I hadn't planned on. And subsequently, it definitely reshaped everything about my life from that day forward.
And Ray, what about you?
You know, there was school, and after school I would usually, because I had 9 o'clock curfew, right, during school days. So I would usually go and meet up with some of my friends. And so on this night, I did the same thing. You know, what are we gonna do? Well, let's meet up after school, let's go hang out. And so what we like to do is, because I hung out with a couple of guys that were older than me, we would love to go to other neighborhoods and they would link up with other people. And we would, you know, talk to their girls and stuff like that. And so this night, it just happened we was going to Schaumburg. And so we walked over to Schaumburg, and, you know, and there was a bunch of people out there, and we were hanging out. Who made the exact call to go into Central Park? I don't know. But me, as a 14-year-old, as a follower, hanging out with guys who were a little bit older than me, who were more experienced than me, I just went along. It was just another day. We hanging out, we going to visit another neighborhood, and after that, I go home. But it wound up not going home, going to prison, and coming back out 7 years later.
So there's a lot of chaos that night in Central Park. There's attacks on bikers. A young white woman is jogging in Central Park, and she's beaten and raped and left for dead. And at the time, this attack is unknown to you both, but shortly after, you're picked up by the police for questioning. What's running through your head as the police are coming to get you, Ray?
Terrified. You don't know what's going on. Afraid, because we were very naive at that point. We was never had no run-ins with the law, you know, so this wasn't something we was accustomed to, so everything is unfamiliar. So you don't know what's going to happen next. You know, all you know is that you're going to the precinct and they say, well, we're going to give you a DAT ticket, you know, to appear in court, and we're going to call your families and tell them to come pick you up. And so we were given, like, misdemeanor charges, you know, trespassing, menacing, stuff like that. It was nothing serious. It was all misdemeanor charges with an appearance in family court. And that's all we thought was going to happen. You know, we didn't even know that they had found a woman in the park. You know, they never told us anything. You know, they just, you know, as parents started to come and they got very late, they said that they had to hold us because some detectives wanted to talk to us. And that's all we knew. We didn't know what actually transpired with the woman until we got into those interrogation rooms.
Yusuf, when does the mention of this rape come up? And when it does, what's running through your head as you're hearing about these events?
So the interesting part about my addition to the story is that I was picked up the next evening. You know, I had went home, got ready for school for the next day, and went to school the next day and came home. And I said, wow, there's a lot of unmarked police officers outside. And in saying that, one of the older guys heard me and said, you know, they're looking for you. I said, they're looking for me for what? You know? He said, well, there was a woman raped in Central Park. Did you hear about it? And I said, a woman raped? I said, I mean, I saw a lot of crazy stuff in the park, but I didn't see a woman get raped. And that was really my first part or my first introduction to hearing anything about this. And so I said, well, I know I didn't do anything. I'm just going to go to the police and, you know, let them know I didn't do anything. And that's going to be that. And the worst thing that I could have done was have that mentality and then go to the police department and come home 7 years later. We were so scared and so overwhelmed by what was going on because, like Ray said, at that point in time, I was being brought into a situation that had went from 0 to 100 just like that. It went from the Central Park police officers investigating some stuff that had happened to now Manhattan North
homicide detectives.
Homicide detectives, the elite, you know, the elite of New York City Police Department now stepping in and saying, we'll take over from now. And, you know, I became a poet. And in one of my poems, I say something like, we didn't have a chance, six youth among apes. In many ways, I think the title of Sarah Byrne's book, which is also the title of the Central Park 5 film, the subtitle of it is A Chronicle of a City Wilding. And this is exactly what they did to us. You know, they trumped up these charges and made it appear as if these are the guys who did this. You know, and as we all know, if it's in the papers, it's true, right?
If it's in the papers, it's true. That's what I heard. That's what I heard. So eventually police begin to interrogate you guys about the rape and beating, and confessions are made. Everyone's implicating that other people in this group of five are there. I feel like a lot of people would ask, why confess if you didn't do it? Can you kind of try and take me through that thought process of when you're being interrogated and why there's these confessions, Ray?
I always tell people that to understand why a person confessed, you have to understand the dynamics that go into that. So first off, you know, you have 14, 15, 16-year-old kids who have no police history, nothing. So now you walk into a situation that's unknown, right? And so now, like you said, you have the elite of the police force. These guys have been on the force over 20 years. They know how to do this stuff in their sleep. So the scale is already tipped. So now you put us in a room. It's cold. There's no food. There's no water. You know, you don't get none to drink. You have to stay up. There's no sleeping. And they're pounding questions. And, you know, in the beginning, they don't start off aggressive. It started very calm. Tell us what happened, right? And you go into the story, tell them what you saw. That's not good enough. Because mm-hmm. as they're doing interrogations, there's Elizabeth Lederer and Linda Fairstein who are out there and they're conducting an investigation. They're acting as lead investigators. And so while they're doing that, they're bringing back what they think are the facts and they're giving it to the police. And so they're bringing it to us, right? So, you know, like the story's already chopped up as it is. There is no truth in there. So they're just giving us what they perceive to be the facts. And so it starts off very, you know, harmless. And as it keeps going on into the wee hours, they become more aggressive. You know, my grandmother, who was there, spoke very little English. They knew that. They had to translate. And so what they would do is, you know, you hear a knock at the door. An officer would come in. He spoke Spanish. He told my grandmother in Spanish, can you step outside? Let me talk to you. Once she stepped outside and that door closed, that was it. This is where they start to do what they're going to do. So, you know, they bring officers in who are very high, very tall, they're towering. They start making, you know, they curse at you and they act like they're going to hit you, physically attack you. And you hear the knock at the door, everything stops. My grandmother comes back in and all she sees is her grandson is shook. You know, he's shaking. She don't know what's going on. And when she tries to ask, we're just trying to find out what's going on here. We don't know. We think he's holding something back. And that goes on for hours. And so once they got me to the point of where they know we're about to break them, they know. You know, these guys are professionals. And in my instance, there was another detective by the name of Detective Hardigan, right, who I don't remember when he got into the room, but I knew he was there. Again, the knock comes at the door. My grandmother steps out. Now, at this point, the guy who's interrogating me, his name is Detective Arroyo. He gets fed up. He bangs on the table. I'm tired of this. You're going to give me what I want? He goes to reach for me. At this point, I'm like, oh, this is it. I'm not going to make it out of here. But something happens. This other detective comes out from the back. He stops him. What are you doing? Starts yelling at him, cursing, push him out the room. Get out the room. They just ran the good cop, bad cop.
Classic good cop, bad cop.
Yeah.
Classic. They did it to a T. And right there, I'm like, this guy just saved my life. And then right there, he starts to perform his magic. Ray, I need your help. Do you know this kid? I don't know Kevin Richardson. Well, I need your help. We know he did it. He's going to jail. I don't want you to go to jail. You're a good kid. This isn't you. I need your help. So right there, I start to formulate a lie. Right? And so Kevin was the first person. Kevin. Okay, Kevin. What did Kevin do? I don't know. I seen him struggle with the woman. But he's writing this stuff down. You know? And so he gave me the names, and I just put them in. Once my statement is finished, and he says, you know, you're a good kid, I'm going to help you, don't worry about nothing. All right? I'm thinking, I got the upper hand. Mm-hmm. So he says, look, but I need you to do one more thing for me. I need you to get this, go to another precinct and give this same statement to somebody else and do a video. And so to me, it's part of the package deal. You want to go home? You got to help out. Fine. But in the process, my statement goes from 2.5 pages to 5 pages, from 5 pages to a video. And when you read the statement, it's all wrong. You know, at approximately 1,700 hours, you know, me and 40 of my friends went into the park and we traveled southbound. Doesn't even sound right.
You know, they swept a lot of things under the rug. They stepped over the bounds of the law. Mm-hmm. You know, they went into other people's job profiles and did their jobs. You know, and this is a big, big problem. But this doesn't just happen in New York City.
It happens everywhere.
It happens everywhere.
That's right.
Right here in Michigan. So you're tried and you're found guilty. What is your reaction to that and the fact that you're going to go to prison as a 14-year-old kid,
man.
Ray?
You know, in the beginning, it was hard because, like Yusuf said, you know, it wasn't, you know, you had all this stuff that we saw as 14, 15-year-old kids, you know, and we're like, how come the public doesn't see this stuff? You know, how come is it that, you know, you can go in and you can take all this forensic evidence. They took our clothes, you know, they hair samples, hand and footprints. You know, they took blood samples. They did everything. And nothing matched, right? And this was a bloody crime scene. They said that they thought she wasn't going to make it, you know. And so that alone, and then you look at the statements themselves and all the discrepancies, you know, and you're like, how come nobody sees this stuff? How come is it that nobody's actually, as a whole, you know, speaking up? On the other side, we were just looked at as the worst human beings on earth. There were 400 articles written on us within the first 2 weeks of this case, dissecting our lives. They went to our schools. They went to our neighborhoods. They put our names. They put our addresses and our telephone numbers in the newspaper. We received death threats. Our family members received death threats. You know, my dad developed a drinking problem because he got ridiculed so much at work. I mean, it got so bad for us that we knew we was going to lose. We knew when we found guilty because we had a meeting with our lawyers. And the lawyers told us, they said, well, you're not going to win.
You're listening to Current State. I'm Emmanuel Berry. I'm here speaking with Yusuf Salam and Raymond Santana, two of the Central Park Five. Yusuf, what did you lose when you went to prison?
I think it's more it's more than just saying that we lost our youth, you know. I mean, we lost every hope of trying to become a successful person. You know, I mean, we had gone to prison. We had been found guilty, and we'd gone to prison for such a heinous crime. The only crime that trumped rape is to go to prison for child molestation. The inmates had been polled on what they was going to do to us when we got to prison. And we knew that our lives was over. So I'm trying to give you an understanding that should point to the fact that to have this stigma on your back and then, you know, going into a space that you have no knowledge of, you know, the belly of the beast, you lose your innocence. You lose your youth. You lose your vision. You lose hopes for the future. You lose everything. And when I say everything, I mean everything. When you become a lost soul, you become worse than the worst free person that's living on the streets, you know? And it puts you in a space that's hard to get out of. Of course, we all know that we never had a prom. We know that we, you know, most of our first, you know, relationship experiences was when we were adults. You know, we didn't know how to fill out job applications until we became adults. All of these experiences that young people kind of gradually come into, we didn't get any of that. So sometimes it's hard to speak about what we lost because we were just coming into ourselves.
It was eventually determined that Matias Reyes, a serial rapist, committed the crime you were convicted of. Interestingly, he was in jail with another of the Central Park Five, Corey Wise, and they spoke.
The whole thing about Corey's involvement with Matias Reyes happened because Corey was on Rikers Island for the time that he was on Rikers Island for. And he happened to be on Rikers Island at the same time the known Eastside rapist was there, which was Matias Reyes. When he saw Corey some 13 years later, 10, 12 years later, it was like after being in prison for so long, after getting God, after realizing, I think, some of the mistakes that he had made, and he wasn't, you know, completely free of all of that, you know, but there was something in that, seeing the hurt and the pain in Corey's eyes and saying, oh, man, I gotta come clean. I didn't realize this guy was still in prison for this crime. I committed the crime. It's a relief that the truth came out. But when I tell you that that relief was short-lived, I mean, my mother was at City Hall, and she was talking about when we got exonerated. And, you know, as Raymond said earlier, there were over 400 articles written within the first few weeks that this case had come out. We hadn't even gone to trial yet, and this is how much people were writing about it. She said she had, you know, when they found out that we were innocent, it was a whisper that she had wondered if the mice heard. People to this day still think that we're guilty.
Because they don't know about exoneration.
They don't know about that.
They don't know.
You know, and when they see this film, like a lot of people, especially young people, you show them, you tell them about the Central Park Five, they think it's a rap group or a music group, you know. But for the older folks who remember that time, it's like watching this film, they're trying to figure out themselves, like, how did we believe that? How did we buy into this false story? I mean, for the first time, we're seeing this with new eyes, and we're realizing we got the wrong people.
Do you feel like this film is giving you relief? Yeah. I mean, is this part of the relief for you guys?
Because what happens is that when those false videotape statements came out, people believe that because it's a visual, right? So it's like no matter what the evidence is, he's saying he did it, he must have did it, that's it. And so now the same thing happened in reverse now. Now you have a film which is 2 hours long of them telling of the facts. But now the difference is that it's us talking, and then now you have Mateus Reyes. And so now people watch this visual, and you see this for 2 hours, and it takes you on this emotional roller coaster, and you go, wow, I've been had also.
Mm. I mean, it's definitely given us our life back. You know, it's funny because of all things that could give us our life back, you know, you would think that being exonerated would have given us our life back. You would have thought that, you know, you would have thought definitely that we wouldn't have been fighting a lawsuit for 10 years. That right there is crazy in and of itself. But to be able to be on the radio with you, you know, to be able to be in front of folks and sharing with them and this experience that happened to us, in many ways has given us a chance to heal. We never went through any kind of therapy sessions or anything like that. And this has been tremendous for us in putting our lives back together. I mean, we can never get back what we've lost.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of moving forward, we've been able to help so many other folks just by letting them know, like, how we've been fighting. A lot of people have come to us and said, man, you guys are inspiring us. I mean, it's not even about, like, this film isn't really just about the Central Park Five. This film is about all of the injustices that go on, you know. And, I mean, we're out here and we're trying to make sure something like the Central Park Five never happens again.
You mentioned the lawsuit briefly, and in many ways the lawsuit is as close as you're going to get to an apology. Winning the suit is as close as you're going to get to an apology from a lot of people who owe you one, in a sense. Is there anyone in particular or that you would want to hear an apology from most?
You know, that's a difficult one because even though we would like to hear, we know we're not going to get them. And so, I mean, I think we're fine with that at this point. You know, I mean, during this lawsuit, we done conducted over 70 depositions. And to hear, you know, Elizabeth Lederer come in there and say that we're still guilty, to hear Fairstein come in there and say that we're still guilty, and all the detectives say all they did was good old-fashioned police work. And so we know we're not going to get the apology. And so, you know, to finally finish this case out, whether we go to trial or whether they settle, that is going to be the closure for us. That's the ultimate sign of victory. Because throughout this whole process, we have went in front of the city council. We have received proclamations from them. We have received proclamations from the state senate. You know, attorney general supports us. You know, Eric Schneiderman. You know, the last city controller, which was John Liu. He spoke out, you know, let's get this case settled. Let's get these guys some justice. And so the only obstacle we had at the end of the day was Mayor Bloomberg.
And now we have a new mayor-elect, Bill de Blasio, and he's going to take office. And it was announced, or Ken Burns said on HuffPo Live, that he's going to settle the case. What does that feel like to know that this could all kind of come to an end soon?
I mean, you know, for me, it feels great, you know, because this has been a battle for over 24 years, and we have lost a lot of people in this process, and, you know, we're getting older. Our kids are getting older, and we feel like it's we're just looking for that time where we could just put a period at the end of this sentence and close this final chapter and then move on to something else. You know, whether it's injustice or programs with kids. And, you know, we have to move on to that next chapter in our lives. And it seems like we've been denied that opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
You know. Yusuf, yeah. What about
this
you?
This has definitely ran us ragged, you know. I mean, man, to be able to finally say, okay, we don't have to go back to court anymore. We don't have to worry anymore. I'm not even talking about money. I'm not talking about money because, see, money doesn't erase the indelible scars, you know. It just so happens that financial compensation is the method that the city gives as a recourse when people are wronged, you know. But to be able to put this behind us finally and to be able to move on without that hindrance is tremendous.
Yusuf Salam and Raymond Santana, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Raymond Santana and Yusuf Salam were in East Lansing for a screening of the Ken Burns film, The Central Park Five. Last week, Burns told HuffPo Live that New York Mayor-elect Bill de Blasio has agreed to settle the 10-year-old Central Park 5 case. For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.